Welcome to another edition of the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, where we discuss a radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose.
Virginia may be on the verge of banning the sale of assault-style weapons. Here's Senate Majority Leader Scott Surovell.
There's some things you can't buy today, like flamethrowers or rocket launchers. You can't have your own tank. That's the law in America today. Why? Because these are weapons of war that are used to kill humans. They're designed to maximize human carnage and to kill people. You don't hunt animals with a tank or a flamethrower.
The legislation banning the sale, manufacture, or transfer of assault-style weapons and large-capacity magazines was sent to the governor's desk on a party-line vote. Here's Senator Bryce Reeves, a Republican from Orange County.
If we don't have the Second Amendment, we're going to end up like Venezuela one day, or we're going to end up like all these other countries that don't have the ability to fight for their freedom against tyranny. And many of the other side of the aisle are worried about our current president and whether or not he's going to try to run again and all these other things that are out there. And for argument's sake, let's say he did. How are you going to stop him? Well, if you take away all the firearms from the law-abiding citizens, I don't think they're going to be able to do anything.
A spokeswoman for the governor says that as a mother of three daughters in Virginia public schools and a former federal law enforcement officer who carried a gun every day, Governor Spanberger knows the importance of making sure kids and families are safe. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Okay, so there we have our story today, the assault weapons ban that seems likely to head to the governor. So with us today are
Dana Ackley, author of A Little Book to Save Humanity.
I'm William Fralin, a former member of the Virginia House of Delegates.
Jay Foster with the Praxis Way.
Cynthia Lawrence with Carilion Clinic, Workforce Development.
David Points, retired educator and military.
Lee Learman, physician who lives in Roanoke.
Joyce Waugh, retired Roanoke Regional Chamber.
Wayne Strickland, former executive director of the Roanoke Valley Allegheny Regional Commission.
Michael Brockta, CIA retired and recent president of the Kiwanis Club of Roanoke.
Okay, guys, so this is not a new debate. This is a debate that's been sort of simmering through for the last 40 or 50 years, I suspect, in and out of the legislature, depending on who's in charge. So does anybody have any initial thoughts about this?
I do.
Joyce?
This seems different from some of the debates that have been in the General Assembly before, in that assault weapons are different from, you know, handguns.
Correct. And if you in the story, it said assault style weapons. And so one of the things that happens is, what is an assault weapon? Is it a semi-automatic weapon, which are used for hunting, which are used for other purposes? Or is it something that looks scary? Is it the same mechanism, the same triggering, the same, you know, squeezes off around as fast as you pull the trigger, but it looks like a fully automatic weapon, or it looks like it's styled for military use. So that's an issue. Yep.
I'll add one question to that. Would that include, you think, those adapters that people seem to be able to buy that would convert a gun to an assault-style weapon?
I'm worried our listeners are going to think I know more about this than I do, because I don't. But what you're talking about is a bump stock, which I do know what it is. It takes a recoil and immediately cocks the trigger again. So it's you're not pulling the trigger with your finger. The recoil is setting it off again, which is not an automatic weapon, but you and I would be unlikely to tell the difference. Cynthia. Wayne.
Yeah, didn't the Congress pass a law back in the 90s or sometime about outlawing assault weapons? And then it came back up again?
I believe there was an assault weapon ban, a national assault weapon ban, that either expired or was repealed. I can't remember which. Michael.
So given that the fact there was an assault weapon ban, then as a country, we have experience dealing with the impact of such a ban. So I wonder, why do we have to have a new conversation and come up with new reasons for pro or against, when we can just look at that segment of our recent history and understand how it went?
That's a very good question. Jay's our data man, and I don't know the data. Like much data, it could be in the eye of the beholder and what you want it to say. I'm not sure.
Well, what's come up in there before is, where do we rank worldwide? Because you can look at other countries, and again, our murder rate, homicide rate is pretty embarrassing on that list. So, but to Mike's point, if we had an experiment, if you will, where we banned these weapons for 5 years or whatever it was, and we found out that these mass shootings drop, because to me, that's what's being lost here. How many mass shootings does it take before you make a change? So you try to stop that from happening.
So I think one of the things that happens is we think about the weapon and the assault weapon, and we forget about the Second Amendment, which is definitely an impediment to what we want to do. And the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed is sort of my paraphrase of that.
But you have to finish that. That is based on a well-organized militia.
Fair.
And that's always left out. So I like the speaker in this segment that said, you know, can't have a tank, can't have a fire thrower. Assault weapons, I would say, if you're a part of an organized militia with people in your community that have credibility, that can keep things in check according to the rule of law, then I would encourage those kind of the response to tyranny. But individuals, and claiming the Second Amendment gives individuals that right, that's where I don't understand.
Some may say an organized local militia is an oxymoron. I mean,
by
definition, the Minutemen, even during the Revolution, were not, I mean, they didn't all show up all the time. They were volunteers. They were, you know, it's a complicated situation. Lee.
We were just talking about mass shootings, and I just thought I would throw in another part to our conversation, and that's the debate between the importance of treating mental illness as a precipitant of mass murder and gun control. And, you know, in my mind, they intersect in a pretty high potency way. So most people with mental illness are not dangerous at all. Most folks that own weapons, like the ones that want to be controlled, aren't going to be mass murderers either. But when you take a look at the intersectionality, if you've got someone who is predisposed to violence due to a mental illness, the last thing you want them to have on their hands is a weapon of mass destruction, such as the one that where the ban is sort of coming into play there. You'd rather be able to control their violence sooner before they're able to kill so many people. So just from a pragmatic basis, it seemed to me that if we're taking a public health approach to this, which I know is not part of the Second Amendment, that perhaps we can understand that when there is an intersection between the two of these at a point of mass murder, that we want to limit the casualties here without overly restricting access to guns.
And so I'll just add one thing to that from the healthcare perspective, the cost to the human sacrifice that occurs when these tragedies happen in our midst. It's not just the patient, although that's pretty significant and tragic, but it's the families and the fallout and the community itself. So I just want to underscore what Lee said about the cost to our health system and our communities writ large when we're dealing with a subject like assault weapons in the hands of those who really don't need to have them.
Dana.
I have to confess a bias. I have almost no personal experience with guns. So I come to it with that bias. But as I listen to the argument about, well, we've got to have guns to prevent the government from coming in and killing us all, that makes no sense to me. I can't see how a bunch of guys, 18 guys with assault rifles, are going to take on the U.S. Army, who are better trained, have better weapons. They've got flamethrowers. They've got tanks. The argument falls flat for me.
Let me ask you this question. It's apples and oranges. It's not the same. What if they had had weapons in Minnesota when the ice was rounding people up? I mean, that would have quickly escalated into something pretty terrible if the militia had come out and dealt with that. Mike.
Interesting.
You know, this issue, of course, is not a new one. It's often framed as a Second Amendment issue. Thankfully, we have two people in the room who just framed it as a more of a health-based issue. My wife and I have traveled quite a bit in the UK and Scotland in particular. I just want to comment. A number of years ago, they had a really horrific mass shooting in Scotland, about 30 or so years ago. And the reaction on the part of the entire country was unanimous. Let's immediately take action to never let that happen again. And so they passed a bunch of rules, and the behavior of the entire country changed. So the point I'm making is there was a call to action, and the nation took it. How many times have we had a call to action and not taken it here? Why aren't we taking some call to action? Why do we keep kicking the can down the street?
So there's a couple issues with that. In Scotland, they don't have the Second Amendment. And so in order to, when you have a, I don't want to go into legalese here, but when you have a fundamental right, Bill of Rights kind of right, usually those are subject to what's called strict scrutiny. In other words, you can regulate those rights, but only if you do it in the least invasive way possible, as opposed to what lawyers call rational basis, which means if you just got a decent reason for it, you can do it. So it's harder in America. And of course, to pass a constitutional amendment, it's got to pass Congress by 2/3, and then it's got to pass 3/4 of the states. That's a very high bar.
But of course, if you take Jay's argument, we don't have that right. It's been misinterpreted.
If we follow the history of the Second Amendment in terms of the history of the United States, many communities who address African-American history, we know that when the Second Amendment passed, within that guideline that slaves were free, slave master said, he's free or she's free. I better protect myself under the guise of Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. So African-American communities, many people look at it to say, well, it was a protectionary measure of those who were in power to have the guns to still suppress African-Americans.
You know, I hadn't thought of that.
Everyone address it up.
No, I hadn't thought of that. But David, you know, I know, for example, in the Revolutionary War, one of the things that Lord Dunmore did was offer freedom to slaves that would come over. And that really, really rattled the colonists, to your point, because now all of a sudden you're going to have slaves with guns, and they lived in a fear of that happening, which I never thought about that reason for the Second Amendment to be in, other than what the militia kind of idea, where if we're subject to tyranny, we can throw it off. Wayne.
You know, there is a difference between a rifle, a 22 or whatever, and an assault weapon, an AR-15. You know, I was in the Army for years. We didn't have AR-15s. We had M-16s. But an AR-15, the shells will go in your body and will break apart and begin to hit as many organs as it can. And if you remember Vivaldi, one of the reasons why the police didn't run to the shooter right away, they said that an AR-15 with whatever shells they were using would have penetrated the Kevlar vest. Mm. It's that powerful.
Okay, you are listening to the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose.
I'm going to come back to what Mike was saying about call to action. And I don't know how it works, the system works in Scotland, where you cited that they all decided we have a goal, and that's for this never to happen again. And why hasn't that happened here? I think here we have to just acknowledge that part of our free speech rights are attached to the ability to raise money and lobby Congress to do or to prevent from being done the things that we believe in. And so I don't think we can deny the power of the lobbying movement that tries to assure access to weapons. I'm not sure how that works in Scotland, whether there's the same opportunity there for that to be a powerful influence or not.
You know, one of the things you hear often, and I don't know if this is fair, but it is what it is unlike Scotland or England, we have millions and millions and millions of weapons out there right now. And if we said we're never going to sell another one, we'd have a long tail before those weapons would become inoperable.
Yeah, we have a weapon for every man, woman, and child in this country.
Okay. So so if you concede that point, what does it mean about your own personal safety if you live in a neighborhood where crime is rampant and where you feel a need to be able to protect your own self because the police might not get there in time? Does that resonate with anyone?
I think you make a good point. Yet there is still, you know, a handgun for protection versus an assault weapon or assault-like weapon. You know, I mean, I can handle a handgun. Not my thing to do, but I can do it. I wouldn't want an assault weapon in my house or, you know, why do you need that for self-defense is my question.
David?
again, if we look at the history and we understand the language, I heard the some of the stabilities in terms of medical variations on why the guns may be used in assault. The only thing that came to my mind on that is in the hood, they're junkies, crackheads, dope addicts. But in the white neighborhood, it's opioid abuse. I grew up in 1967. Oh, I didn't grow up in 1967. I was 13, 14 years old in 1967 during the riots. The National Guard during the riot was supposed to protect the citizens. 39 black folks were killed at random. So when the development of that community grows up, the table discussion comes and white folks are afraid, black folks are afraid, brown people. Don't ever let the police come in your house and you're not armed. So if we call it an assault weapon or a gun or whatever, however we identify that, protection is important. But who had the power to make the laws who abused the system?
Right. And just for our listeners, I believe, David, you were in Detroit.
Yes, Detroit.
So, which was definitely a racial hotbed and a lot of violence took place there. Wayne.
Well, you know, Joyce has a point about having a handgun. I don't know how many of you have weapons. I mean, I have a few myself. But to stop somebody, I mean, a handgun would be sufficient. But the fellow, remember, in Las Vegas with the bump stock, killed, what, 69, 79 people because he was able to fire that rapidly into a crowd. And if he had a handgun, he would the damage would not have been like that.
Mike?
You know, when I step back from this kind of conversation, I see it through the lens of classic American individual rights and freedoms versus the greater social good. And what price are we willing to pay to maintain those individual rights and freedoms? Or what are we willing to give up for the greater social good? And, you know, that's a societal question that gets played out mostly, I guess, in the legislature these days, because that's where these rules are passed or not passed. Just a comment.
Yeah, and in our system, that's where it's designed to be handled. Yeah.
As a partial commercial message, the Roanoke Collaboration Project has a constructive dialogue pledge that is available at our website. And if we had more constructive dialogue, we'd have many fewer gun incidents.
I agree with that, and I would encourage listeners to look at that pledge. I think it's pretty powerful.
And what's that URL again?
I'll have to get it as soon as Mike talks.
Well, I'll answer that question for you. It's not the first time I've bailed out a former politician.
Fair enough.
So it's the RoanokeCollaboration.org website.
Right here. RoanokeCollaboration.org website, Dana. Of course.
Oh.
I should have memorized it, but I haven't.
Jay? So going back to your question, William, if there's neighborhoods in Roanoke that are under fear because of other people that have guns, my mind goes back to the question of how are we doing against other communities per 100,000, right? And unfortunately, a couple of years ago, we had one of the highest homicide rates by guns in the nation in Roanoke. My position would be the system is starting to break down if you have to have people arm themselves to defend themselves personally, you know, as opposed to the rule of law in Roanoke having the right resources to manage violent crime to keep it in check. I don't think guns help. That's the point.
Lee?
Just coming back to another public health principle that resonates with me. We talk about a harm reduction model for things that are dangerous and we can't control. We can't stop them, but how do we reduce the harm? Some would argue that the limitations on assault weapons would be one approach to that, but there are many others that are often not emphasized. Those of you with guns know how to secure them, how to make sure that no one who's not supposed to access them will not. And yet we see children with guns who are killing people by accident or on purpose, as happened recently with one of the mass shootings. And when you peel the onion on that, there are people who should not ever have had access to these weapons. And so we have to think about, you know, more holistically whether or not this ban goes into effect or not, how we make sure that we're looking at all the different levers that we can use to reduce the death rate.
Right. And of course, we have background checks, and felons are not allowed to purchase weapons, at least legally, and people who have been adjudicated mentally ill and things like that. Of course, that doesn't, it's not foolproof. So, Cynthia?
Yeah, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, after Lee's comment, about one of our local heroes, Brenda Hale, who does the gun take back for our youth. And I think from a community response perspective, to your point, getting the guns out of the hands of children and getting responsible adults to come forward and turn in guns that are unnecessary, I applaud her and her colleagues and others that do that. So while we're talking about the legal process, I think there are some community responses that are going on right here in our neighborhoods.
Right. David?
Media has a strong influence. Black on black crime. I've never heard white on white crime. But we hear about mass shootings. So if we continue to sell that message in the press, it makes people hesitant, afraid to go in certain areas. Now they have a valid reason based upon media stories to have a gun.
Right.
And sometimes that gun makes people feel superior.
Right. And so, you know, when you were just saying that, David, it's interesting. I was looking, thinking back just through my mind, unfortunately, the recent mass shootings that we've seen, very few African-Americans perpetrating that. That I can remember. I mean, I may be not thinking right. I don't know why that is, but.
No, you're right, William. My daughter is in communications, but worked for Boulder PD. And one of her first, she hadn't been there 5 months when the King Super shooting, you know, happened, you know, and to have, and that was a first in a while, but Colorado's had its fair share of these kinds of things. And it, you know, the impact, to Cynthia's point and others, you know, the impact is so great on, you know, the ripple in the community, but in our nation too, in our psyche, I think.
How many times can you look back where the gun was abused to make a statement? And one of the things that came to my mind is the young man jogging through the neighborhood, the car blocking him off and shooting. And the legal system held up the process for a while because they didn't want the story to get out. What does that tell black people? See, you can't answer that.
Mm-hmm.
So the gun becomes the measure of, I'm going to have my gun too.
What I hear you saying, David, is if the system isn't going to protect me, I better protect myself.
Well, that's what the Second Amendment said. They had to have guns against the former slaves.
That's true.
Okay. Well, and so, you know, and the other thing is there's a string of thought about a weapon, and we're sort of getting off the assault weapon topic, which is fine. I mean, we're coming close to the end of our time, but is a very much of an equalizer. If you are a female walking down an alley and a big male is threatening you, that's a way to be able to protect yourself when you would not physically be able to do that otherwise. You sure?
Well, there's far better ways to protect yourself one-on-one with another human being, like spray, right? Pepper spray, for example. So again, some of the training in terms of concealed weapon is that the bar should be exceptionally high to shoot somebody. But again, this is individuals fighting with each other. Is that really what the Second Amendment was supposed to be about?
Well, and from a legal standpoint, what the law would say is, you're right. The bar is high to shoot somebody.
It should be.
Right. Well, you mean regardless of whatever kind of weapon you have to be in fear for your safety. You've got to be able to demonstrate it. You've got to be able to understand that in some states you have to back up, in some states you don't, which is a controversial thing, but yeah, there are definite rules about that. Definite rules about that.
I mean, where I was going with that is that de-escalation is another thing that I don't think we spend enough time on. And trying to teach the community, it is important to protect yourself, right? But in most cases in the public, if you had pepper spray as one example, you don't have to be carrying guns to try to take care of protecting
yourself.
How does
the background check fit into all this? Does that mollify any concerns that we may have? I mean, is that a positive thing? I think it probably is.
I don't know that it really matters. It hasn't seemed to really matter. It may have prevented some, but what about the little ones that have gotten hold of guns, you know, that shouldn't have, or, you know, the rest of it. But I think that if there's a need, I don't think it's for assault or for the average individual, assault or assault-like kind of weapon.
Okay, Mike?
Years ago, my wife and I were young and were having our first child. We read to that child every night. And one of the most popular series of books we read were the Berenstain Bears. And one of that child's favorite...
I'm concerned about where this is going.
One of that child's favorite books was titled A Culture of Violence. So that's quite a few years ago that we started having our children pay attention to this subject, isn't it? How far have we come or not come in the meantime? Just saying.
Yeah, and what about the idea of, to get us really off topic since we're winding up, these first-person shooter games, the video games.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, Lee, I think you had it.
But, you know, education. I think that we've circled around this in a lot of ways, but education on at younger levels, older, you know, all the way up. And I know, where's the money, all the other things, and individually as parents, you know, it's important. But there are ways to do this. And a lot of kids are not taught how to de-escalate. A lot of adults don't know how to de-escalate. You know, could save some lives.
Absolutely. Mike.
Joyce, you know, a good way to de-escalate is to have a collaborative discussion with the people of different viewpoints, which is kind of exactly why we're doing this radio broadcast.
Great idea.
Right. Dana was mic dropping for those of y'all that can't see.
You know, Dana made the comment just a little while ago about national defense and all, and protecting yourself from the government. Well, it was interesting, the fellow who was quoted, the legislator who was quoted, said that, well, you know, they could come out at any time and come and get you. I thought to myself, I don't see that. I mean, I just don't see that we need a rifle or AR-15, whatever it may be, to protect ourselves because the government's going to come knocking our door down. I don't know. I could see personal protection if you're in a position where you're threatened, then, but just to have something to say that you're going to be attacked by the government.
Unless you're an immigrant.
Yeah, or Alex Priddy. So again, not to bring that up at the last minute, but again, he was attacked by an ICE officer who clearly went over the line. When he pushed that woman down on the ground, that was assault. He broke the law right there. So Alex Priddy brought a gun to a protest. And it was ironic to see the right respond so strongly and say, oh, you shouldn't be bringing guns to protest. I go back to the what was the purpose of the Second Amendment. If you have an out-of-control police officer like that, what are you supposed to do? It could have gotten so much worse.
Right. Well, not to argue, but you were just saying we don't need guns. We just de-escalate. So maybe you just should have de-escalated. I did get that. I got the sense of somebody sitting out there watching, go, okay, walking down an alley. Somebody's coming to rob me. I'm supposed to, what, de-escalate? This guy's going, looks like he's going to rob me anyway.
What you doing walking down the alley at night anyway?
Going to your car after a play.
Right. In the alley?
Well, there are some alleys here.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Any final thoughts before we wrap up? Okay. Well, you've been listening to another edition of the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose. Thank you for joining us. Look forward to seeing you next time.